You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
My name is Tom Hilbank. I'm a program officer in the Transparency and Integrity Funded U.S. Programs, and welcome to the Open Society Institute for the Future of Liberty, Equality, and the U.S. Constitution.
Wow.
We're really excited to have this panel of guests. I did want to make a few announcements. There are keys for the bathrooms, which are out this door to my left, straight out and to your left. There are books. Copies of the Constitution in 2020 are on sale, and I think at a very competitive price, as I'm told. Copies of Keeping Faith with the Constitution are at a very competitive price, i.e. they are free. So please take advantage of those opportunities on your way out. And we will, I'll turn this over now to Ann Beeson, who is the Executive Director of U.S. Programs at the Open Society Institute. Before joining OSI in 2007, she was Associate Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union and has argued twice in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, so this is an issue that is near and dear to her heart. So, thank you.
Thank you, Tom. And can people hear me? Is this thing on now? You guys can hear? Great, wonderful. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm supposed to read this card now. My goodness, I was just handed this. So I'm just delighted to be able to moderate this session. Before we get started, I'm supposed to let you all know that this event is being recorded for posterity. When we get to the Q&A period, which we hope will be substantial because we're very eager to engage all of you in this conversation, it would be terrific if you could come up to the mics and talk to the microphone and just be aware that you are going to be recording. We're going to rebroadcast this panel on our website. So with that, I want to just welcome all of you to this important conversation about the Constitution. We have up here what I would call a Constitution dream team. If any of you ever have your constitutional rights violated, you would want to call one or all of the people on this panel. And I think we're going to have a really lively conversation. We're not going to do this talking head style. We're going to engage in a kind of ongoing dialogue about some of the issues that are discussed at length in these two terrific books. And I want to just, before we begin, mention again and hold up the two books. Tom mentioned them before. We've been very pleased to be able to support in different ways the publication of both of these books. The first, The Constitution in 2020, and the second, Keeping Faith with the Constitution. Everything you want to know about the Constitution and the future of the Constitution in the United States is pretty much in these books. So I very much encourage you all to read them, and I'm sure that many of our panelists were involved in either editing or writing essays for the books. And you'll hear a little bit more about them as we go on. I'm not going to do lengthy introductions at all. I'm just going to quickly identify each of our panelists. And I'll just do that quickly, going from my right. Christina Rodriguez is a professor of law at NYU. We have Reva Siegel, who is one of the editors of the Constitution 2020 book, and who is the deputy dean at Yale. We have John Payton, head of NAALP. We have Pamela Carlin, a contributor to one of the books, right, article from Pam, and author of this book. And Pam is a terrific professor at Stanford Law School. We have Sherilyn Eiffel, who is a professor at University of Maryland School of Law, and is also, we are very delighted, a board member for the U.S. Program Board here at OSI. And then, of course, last but not least, we have Jack Balkin, also a professor at Yale. Again, a dream team up here. And I want to begin with just a very a general question. I mean, here we are, and we're so delighted to have all of you, members of the public at large, here to talk about the Constitution. My first question is about conversations about the Constitution. And the question is, how do we engage the broader public in the conversation about the Constitution and the future of the Constitution? And why is it important that we do so? Why is it important that we get beyond just legal conversations and talking about the Constitution? And I want to ask each of the panelists to quickly answer that question. And I think I'll start at the far end. Jack, you want to take a stab at that one?
Sure, although I guess what I would say is that talking about the Constitution is actually pretty simple. The basic principles are really simple. You know, we have a text. It's the same text we had before. It's been amended. We should apply the text. It has principles. We should apply those principles in our own time. It's our duty to apply them in our own time. And I think that's the way we should talk about it. We should talk about the Constitution as ours. I think it's really important that Americans think of the Constitution as theirs and not just simply something that belongs to courts. They should claim it as their own. They should claim its principles and its standards as their own. And that's the way we should talk about it.
So, Sherrilyn, if you were to walk up on the street to your average person in Baltimore, would that make sense to them?
No. it's interesting. I'm not sure that it's possible to have a conversation about the Constitution that's not an insider's conversation. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that average people have conversations about constitutional principles all the time, mm-hmm. especially in a place like Baltimore, in which people kind of run up against the Constitution in a variety of ways in their interactions with police and what happens in their communities in terms of how decisions are made and resources are allocated and so forth. The only country I've been to where people talk explicitly about the Constitution, average people, is South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's an unusual thing for people not to talk about the Constitution. Mm-hmm. But what I do think, and I think this kind of builds from Jack's point, is that there is a way in which we ought to kind of be piggybacking on how people talk about constitutional principles, mm-hmm. because they are talking about what the police can and can't do in their community. They are talking about sentencing. They are talking about what happens in prisons. They are talking about abuse. They are talking about those issues. And I think the challenge for us is figuring out how to get out of our insider conversation about the Constitution, mm-hmm. and how to have a more accessible conversation about constitutional principles with people on the ground who are really running up against the Constitution quite personally every day.
Right. Terrific. Pam?
Well, and I think one of the things that is really important to get across to people is the Constitution both tells the government things they can't do, but also tells the government the things that it can do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an area where we're seeing a lot of discussion these days around things like the survival of the Second Reconstruction, which is about constitutional principles of equality, but it was what Congress and the President did in response to the Civil Rights Movement and not what the courts did that really turns out to be critical, mm-hmm. to the survival of things like the Second Reconstruction. And so I think a lot of the discussion is not about constitutional interpretation and textualism versus strict construction versus the living Constitution, but it's about what does the Constitution mean today? And when people understand that a lot of what they expect the government to be able to do, or a lot of what they think the government shouldn't be able to do, is governed by constitutional principles, you can have a conversation with them about those principles. And I'll just say one last thing about this, which is, if you went up to the average person on the street in Baltimore and asked them, what rights does the Constitution give you? The first thing, I bet you, that comes out of people's mouths is privacy. And yet that's a right that, you'd have to play the Constitution backwards and it would tell you Ringo is dead before you'd be able to find the word privacy.
John, in the whale, LDF has obviously weighed in on these issues for a very long time. Why do you think it's important for the broader public to be engaged in these questions today?
I think it's sort of come out of what we've heard so far. I think for the most part, people are so far removed from what their Constitution does and doesn't do, they would not be able to answer that question intelligently. We don't let people see what is argued in the Supreme Court. We let someone come out and tell them what it was. People don't read the decisions themselves because they think they can't get them. It's not accessible. I think they would have said in answer to the question, I have a right to a lawyer. They would have recited Miranda, which they've heard a million times, and think they know something out of that. And I think most people think they have rights on the basis of what they learn from Law and Order and other shows like that. I bet if you ask people, that's what you'll get. You'll get that coming right back out of them. These are concepts that people ought to better understand, better appreciate, and we have to talk in ways that any audience here would understand what it is we're trying to explain. And if we can't explain it to them, we have to go back and figure out how we can explain it to them. These are core issues. It's not just privacy. It's what is equality. And what is political participation? What should our criminal justice system do? Do you have a right to education? I think most people think you do. Why should we have that discussion? And I think if we don't make that the broader discussion, it'll be just inside baseball. And at the end of that discussion, it's other people that will decide the constitutional rights and not the people whose rights they are.
Which unfortunately is what we have happening today. Reba.
I guess I'd like to answer the question by telling a little bit of a story about where the idea of the Constitution in 2020 as a book came from. Some of us learned actually through Dawn Johnson, who's still waiting for nomination to head the Office of Legal Counsel, about the Constitution in 2000, which was a document or a set of documents in the Meat Justice Department of the Reagan presidency that set forth a set of lines of cases that were approved and disapproved in areas that will ring a familiar bell to you, involving race and the criminal law and separation of church and state and federalism and the family and reproductive rights. And when we heard about the Constitution in 2000 project, many of the lines of cases which the document disapproved of were no longer law or had been bent in such ways that the law had changed. And this was an act of utopian constitutionalism of a kind. It was the conservatives looking at the law of the Warren and Burger courts and saying, that's not the Constitution rightly understood. And by the time the documents we were hearing about were actually being implemented, they were bureaucratic documents. They were top-down sort of litigation instructions and appointments instructions from the Justice Department. So what do you get from it? It was provocation for us to think, what might the Constitution be in 2020, right? We understood. But I guess for purposes of this question, I sort of back out and say, what did it take for the Constitution in 2000 as a document to exist in the Justice Department? It took conservatives going out and saying to people what the courts are doing in respect of where you send your kids to school or how you raise your family or how you worship your God is wrong and not the Constitution, and moving them by pointing to harms in their communal lives to do something about it. That's how the people got elected, to be in the position to create that document. And so it turns out that the set of issues that conservatives associate with nominations and the Constitution of the Court were ones that actually, through kind of populist organizing and mobilizing and direct mail campaigns and whatnot, got put on the agenda and now come to be sites of political conflict. And so I guess I would say if progressives are thinking about that question, they can do what law professors do, which is to sit around and think about how the framing doctrines in these areas need not be and could be otherwise. But the bigger picture question is, how do you associate people's sense of what matters, their vision about proper, good community with their authoritative claim on law? So that's both motive and role confidence to assert oneself, and that's going to be in electoral politics and not just in civic classes.
Christina?
I do think people have a pretty strong sense of the Constitution. I think it provides the language through which we talk about our values, as Sherilyn mentioned. And I think that in many ways it's what people consider to define our national identity. I think people are very proud of the fact that we have the longest lasting constitution in the history of the democratic world, though there can be debate about whether or not that's true. And I think at the same time, there is a big disconnect, and this goes to a point that John made, between the way that the court elaborates the constitution and what people think of as the constitution. A major difference between the multi-part balancing tests or the legal doctrines that the court elaborates and what people think of as the meaning of the constitution. And to the list that Pam started, I would add freedom of speech would probably be the first thing people would say is unique about the United States. And so I think part of the challenge is bringing closer together what the work of the court is and people's understanding of the constitution, because there are times when the court comes out with a decision
And people are confused. How could it be that the government can't do that? Or how could it be that the government can do that? And sometimes what the court has done is appropriate. Sometimes it's divorced from the sociological facts that should inform the way we understand the Constitution. And knowing how to bridge that gap, I think, is an important role for people interested in advancing a, whether it's a progressive vision of the Constitution or a popular version of the Constitution to enable. And then finally, to circle back to something that Jack said, I think that while it's important to apply the Constitution in our own time and figure out what these high-level values mean in a current setting, I think people also have this deep-seated need for a connection to some kind of tradition, and the role that tradition plays in understanding what these values are is an important role for anyone who's engaged in constitutional interpretation to come to understand, and to harmonize that with contemporary values, I think is what the average person thinks of as the role of a constitution, and our constitution in particular.
I'm not going to take us, you know, into one specific issue that has been very much in the news. It's a timely, it's an appropriate time to be having this conversation because, as you all probably know, the Supreme Court term just ended, and there were a number of end-of-term decisions that were quite important. In one of them, you know, the Voting Rights Act sort of narrowly escaped, or at least the key provision of it being overturned as unconstitutional. And my question really comes out of a question that Pam Carlin asked in her article, her chapter in the 2020 book, which is, what would it mean to develop an affirmative conception of the right to vote? And Pam, I'll let you answer your own question first and then ask a couple of other panelists to weigh in as well.
Well, the starting point for my asking that question was the fact that if you read the constitutional provisions that deal with the right to vote, they're all kind of phrased in the negative. They don't say you have a right to vote. What they say is the right to vote that you have can't be denied on the basis of sex or on the basis of race or failure to pay a poll tax or the like. But it turns out, because, of course, voting is something that is connected to the government. You don't vote in the state of nature. You go in and you vote in a polling place. That we have a real democratic deficit in the United States. So, it's really inspirational, to go back to Sherilyn's point about South Africa, it's really inspirational in 1994 to see people standing in line for 8 hours in the hot sun in South Africa to vote. It's kind of disgraceful to see people standing in line for 8 hours in Columbus, Ohio to vote. Now, why is that? Because we've never developed a conception that says you have the right to cast a ballot easily, in a language you understand, to have that ballot counted properly. And when the government actually wants to find out about you, they have ways of doing it. And yet they don't use those to make sure that they make it easy for people to vote and like. And so some of what I think we need to be doing is getting beyond the things that the Constitution prohibits to an argument that the government actually should be required to make it easy for people to register, to make it easy for people to cast their ballots and have them counted, and should develop ways of conducting elections that actually reflect popular views, which the current system doesn't really do very well. So that's kind of what the impetus for the question is that we talk too much about preventing problems with voting and not enough about actually making sure that people find it easy to vote and to have their votes reliably counted.
Mm-hmm. And Sherilyn, you may want to say a little bit more about what the current modern, quite significant impediments are still to right.
Oh gosh, the list goes on and on. I mean, I live in a state. I live in Maryland, which is a fairly progressive state with leaders who care a lot about voting. And I spent the last 2 years co-chairing a task force on voting that was created by our Attorney General after we had the most amazing irregularities in our election in 2006, in the primary election in 2006, many of which involved the current chair of the Republican National Committee, Michael Steele, who was running for lieutenant governor, along with then incumbent Bob Ehrlich. And we went around the state. And, the most important thing to remember about voting is that voting is local. And so it's great that Barack Obama is president, but, when we went out to the Eastern Shore and people talked about an intimidating police presence at certain polling places, that's not what happens in Baltimore, but that is what happened in those communities. So there is this, there is a story about voting that is really very much on the ground and very local, and I think we have to connect with that story. I want to go out on a limb, though, and say one other thing, and this I think even relates back to the first question you asked, Anne. I'm really of the belief that we have to be aware of the fact that there is a very robust conversation happening about voting right now. And I just actually wrote an article about this for a book that Kristen Clark from LDS is co-editing. And I write about television voting, which we would all like stop at because we are focused on political voting. But I got kind of hooked into monitoring all of these TV shows, American Idol, So You Think You Can Dance, and all that stuff, fairly late, about the third season in. But I got in because I heard my children and other young people having the most complicated, sophisticated conversation about voting that I've ever heard. They were single-shot voting. There was race. There was gender. This year we just had sexual orientation. All of these issues were present. And these young people, mostly young people, are voting. They'll stay up to vote. They're willing to use their cell phone minutes to vote. They're willing to be strategic about voting. And what I get from that is that it's not that people don't like to vote. It's that they want to vote when it's convenient. Mm-hmm. They can do it on their cell phone. They don't have to go anyplace. They want to be able to vote passionately. You can vote 35 times for Fantasia if you love her, and you don't have to vote for anybody else if you don't like them. There are all these features to television voting, and that we need to recognize that there's a generation of young people. This is how they're learning how to vote. You can say what you want to say about your electronic machines and all that, but if they're about 9 years old, that's how they started voting, by thinking they can vote for who they want to, when they want to, however much they want to, that they can vote week after week for that person, that they have a relationship with that person. So the article I wrote is about the ways in which I think Barack Obama's candidacy kind of benefited from TV voting and the phenomenon of TV voting. But I say all that to say that there is a conversation about voting that's happening. We just think we're too good for that conversation. And it goes back to your first question. I'm very interested when I talk with young people about voting in connecting their voting experiences. These are real voting experiences for them. We may scorn them, but they're real for them. Mm-hmm. With real results, with real politics, with real strategy, and trying to get them to then make that jump to the very point that Pam was making, which is about the importance of having convenience in voting. There was a whole issue about calling and getting the busy signal, which was the equivalent of there being a long line, right, and people go home. And so some people were not voting on these TV shows because every time they tried to call, there was a busy signal. And it created such a furor that the television program at AT&T had to add additional hours, like, when you go to the court and you say, keep the polling place open because the line is so long. I mean, they're doing all of that, and they get that. So when you can kind of capture the way in which they see voting and switch that conversation into the pieces that Pam's talking about, I think then we start having a conversation which is respectful of what's happening in pop culture that does affect the way people interact with their constitutional rights. Mm-hmm. And it helps us also see, I actually think there are things we can learn about the ways in which people want to vote that we ought to be pursuing that perhaps we're not pursuing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Go ahead, Pam.
Which is especially important given that this is the integrity of program, which is there's another discussion that's going on that I think we on the left have to be responsive to, which is a discussion in which instead of people thinking that the problem is that not enough Americans participate, mm-hmm. they've been led to think that the problem is there's too much fraud.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so the entire frame within which these things get played out is one of fraud. And then to tie that into something else, I had a back and forth when we were doing the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 2006 with Senator Cornyn, who said, I don't understand why we should have ballots printed in languages other than English. I mean, if people are going to be citizens of the United States, don't they have to pass a literacy test? Mm-hmm. And of course, I want to say, and if you had to pass a literacy test, maybe you wouldn't have said it, but there was
taping.
Yeah, but the thing is, he doesn't seem to understand, first of all, people who were born in the United States and don't read English are citizens of the United States. Second of all, the place in the United States where we have oral interpreters is on the Navajo Nation reservation, and to say these people are not American enough to vote is kind of wrong. And the third thing is, to pass the citizenship test, you don't need the language of level of literacy you need in order to effectively negotiate a ballot. And so I think we need to really change the discussion out there in public about the problem being not enough Americans vote and not that too many people are voting who shouldn't.
Well, and as you say, the notion that the government should have an affirmative obligation to facilitate voting is just not even part of the conversation. John, what are some of the affirmative solutions the government ought to be considering?
Well, I think the big frame is the frame you just sort of elicited there. You know, we have a lot of squabbles about whether or not it was okay to have the following voter registration requirement, and then we have a debate about whether that burden was a burden that the Constitution allows. And by the way, you have to get an ID that has a government photo on it, and but if you really wanted to, you could really do it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a history, so I'm going to, since it takes it out of the current politics, 100 years ago, when Mississippi disenfranchised every black person in Mississippi. And that goes before the U.S. Supreme Court. The argument defending it went sort of like this. And Mississippi disenfranchised black people by saying, you have to register, and the registrar can simply reject for any reason it wants. And actually, it can reject you for crimes that relate to being a black person, and that is walking off your sharecropper property. Is a crime that disenfranchises you. Murder doesn't, by the way. And the Supreme Court upholds this in a horrible case, mm-hmm. and it says, but what were they to do? The 15th Amendment said that they couldn't discriminate on the basis of race, so they can discriminate on the basis of the characteristics of the Negro race.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's actually the language. And Alabama does the same thing, and in a hideous opinion by Alden Wendell Holmes, he says, what are we to do? All the white people don't like you, okay? We can't give you a remedy if all the white people don't like you. You have to go get some other remedy because all the white people don't like you. It's a disgraceful opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That's, Williams versus Mississippi, Giles versus Harris, they're notorious cases, no one studies them anymore. That frame is this same narrow frame, okay? That frame is this same narrow frame. Let me give you another case where I think you can see the frame is completely different. Again, a historical case, but, in the days before we think of ourselves as enlightened, the white primary is challenged by the Legal Defense Fund. It's in Texas. It's another way of disenfranchising all black people. You say, you can vote, but you just can't vote in the only primary that matters, the Democratic primary, because it's an all-white Democratic primary. Okay, that's challenged. The defense is, but the Democratic Party is a private party. The Constitution doesn't protect you. They can discriminate any time they want. Okay, this is Smith versus Allwright. It's a dramatically successful case. Okay, this is the Supreme Court in Smith versus Allwright. The United States is a constitutional democracy. Its organic law grants to all citizens the right to participate in the choice of elected officials without restriction by any state because of race. This grant to the people of the opportunity for choice is not nullified by a state through casting its electoral process in a form which permits a private organization to practice racial discrimination in the election. Constitutional rights would be of little value if they could be thus indirectly denied. Okay? That's the frame, that's the large frame. And so it would say how we want people to participate in our democracy. That's important to our democracy. That's how I'm going to analyze this registration requirement or this ID requirement or how this works. It's a completely different affirmative view of what the responsibility is for the government to make sure we have the democracy that we want to have, as opposed to, I think there's nothing wrong with that restriction, it seems fine to me. If you change the frame, what I just read, you can't end up. All this is the predicate frame.
Mm-hmm.
You can't end up with Williams versus Mississippi or Giles versus Harris if you start with, we're a constitutional democracy where everybody ought to be allowed to participate.
Right.
Okay? And I think the first point about this conversation is where you start in this discussion can determine where you end in this discussion. And if you start with the big frame of we're a constitutional democracy, and this is what that means, it will drive some of the questions and drive some of the answers to some of those questions. And what, the Ronald Reagan Justice Department, what Ed Meese did was turn it upside down, and that drives what those questions are, and it drives what those answers are. And I think this effort is to actually reframe these questions, which are core questions. The issues in these books, absolutely core questions.
Mm-hmm.
Where you start in that discussion, I think will play a big role in where you end up.
Absolutely. A number of other recent court decisions have unfortunately undermined Congress's powers, in particular to advance equality. My next question is, what needs to change among the three branches of government to make the Reconstruction Amendment fulfill personnel, but we want to do that too, to make the Reconstruction Amendment fulfill the promises they made after the Civil War? So, Reba, you want to take a crack at that one first?
So, a minute or two background. The Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, we tend now to view them as the business of courts to enforce them, but at the time they were ratified, the court was equated with Dred Scott, and the expectation was that Congress would have an active role in enforcing the amendments, and as Reconstruction itself was engulfed in conflict, the court's authority to act on behalf of civil liberties was engulfed in conflict.
But Chief Justice Taney stayed in office past the adoption of those amendments and was not trusted.
So, that leads to this.
On the short version of this story, it's worth remembering that all of these amendments have an enforcement clause that says that Congress has the power to enforce the provisions of these articles by appropriate legislation. If there's any express enforcer of those amendments, it's Congress and not the court. And yet, in recent years, the court has taken the view that it draws on the collective memory of its role in enforcing civil rights and somehow or other addresses Congress as a threat to civil rights and goes on the offensive and raises, either strikes down provisions of the Violence Against Women Act, portions of the ADA. It's now threatening the Voting Rights Act. It's threatening the 64 Civil Rights Act in various dimensions. It's kind of making these rattling noises again as if the sole enforcer is the court, as opposed to it being a co-venture. So, on the short version of this question, we need to find ways to make people notice that the court is acting in this way and that something in our civil liberties is at stake. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to notice that there's a whole conception of who enforces the Constitution mm-hmm. that's at stake here, not just the scope of Congress's power to enact particular pieces of legislation, but how it is we see the very project of enforcing the Constitution, whether we see legislators as engaged in that act, what's at stake in seeing that? They can engage in responsive interpretation. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they can be hearing on the ground different views about the nature of equal rights in matters of same-sex relations or in matters of race discrimination, and they deserve deference and authority when they're articulating those understandings. They also are in a position to enforce rights in ways that courts can't. Not just that they may be in tune, but they also may have forms of democratic authority to do things like enact the Family and Medical Leave Act. People might view the issue of sex discrimination as solely something for courts to enforce, but that statute, which is requiring employers to make certain amounts of, in this case, unpaid leave available to their employees for purposes of their own health care needs or some discrete sets of family care issues, which many families are now coming to rely on, is a way of enforcing equal citizenship that the Congress is in a position to do, which would have seemed as totally out of bounds if the court had done it. And so what's at stake, as I understand it, is a sort of a confidence in our legislators to act, a sense that they have responsibilities, and a sense also that questions of constitutional of citizenship live in areas that perhaps courts don't go. And so I guess I wanted to move the question from the particulars of whether the court ought to be threatening the Congress as it is, and the difficulties that I think Congress has faced in educating people to know or care about this matter, to the larger question of whom we see to be charged with responsibility to oversee the vindication of those guarantees that people believe and equate with citizenship in the membership.
Well, Sherilyn, I was going to go to you next, Sherilyn, but I also wanted to bring in the executive branch. What a concept. We might have an executive branch that had some role also in affirmatively, you know, promoting and protecting the Constitution. So if you could speak to that as well.
You know, I'm very moved by what Reva said. I'm also find myself responding to it as an African American, mm-hmm. in the sense that Congress is a majoritarian institution, and it's nice to talk about the Reconstruction Amendment, and it's really nice to talk about the years, of like 1957 to 65 as a period in which Congress, did its job.
Yeah.
But if it's the Tom DeLay Congress, that African Americans are deeply suspicious of, regardless of the reality that exactly what the enforcement clauses say, of Congress, being entrusted with that power and the court not taking a very aggressive role, because most of Congress's history is fairly shameful on this point. And so it's a hard sell, is what I'm saying, is that there is the reason why I think many people came to feel more comfortable with the courts is because of Congress's timidity, hesitation, and sometimes downright hostility to doing its job under the enforcement clauses of the Reconstruction Amendment. At the same time, there's an education piece to this also. I mean, we flippantly said, personnel, but I'm not sure that many members of Congress actually have read the entirety of either the 13th. Well, I'm not sure that many of them have read the 13th Amendment, period. I'm not sure that those who have read the 14th and 15th Amendment have gone beyond Section 1 of either of those amendments. I do think that there is a kind of a lack of understanding of what Congress's, historical role was meant to be. But I guess I just mean to say there is reason to fear. Just because we're in this moment, I'm not going to get all warm and fuzzy about Congress. And so it's problematic.
Sure, and then John, I'm sure, wants to jump in on this.
I wanted to say briefly that, to the extent I've done writing in this area, all of the work I've done has been about a vision that sees both courts and the representative branches as important in this story. And there's at least some work out there now that really sort of is kind of off the course, and it's all about popular mobilization. And I'm not for that. And I actually think that if I were going to try to distill down what's really dreadful about the Section 5 cases, it's that it's how the court is abusing its power of review. In other words, that it's going after civil rights legislation rather than all these other acts of bias, because Lord knows existing, if we want to look at the enforcement of the criminal law or national security, there's plenty of work for courts to do. And it's a question of where that sort of, at this point, nationally revered authority is being exercised and misdirected. So we have to have that conversation, not about getting them out of business. And then the second part is to teach people to look to what it is they can be proud of historically, and then hold their representatives accountable. I mean, it would be great if people could say, this is a matter of equal citizenship to me, health care, and be talking to Congress in that register. But I don't think it's about giving up on court.
The rights that we were trying to say, people would say they could identify in the Constitution, free speech, mm-hmm. right to counsel, privacy, it will turn out that I believe almost everything people would say is a right that comes through the 14th Amendment with respect to the states. Mm-hmm. And that's actually how this comes up. Where do your rights come from? It turns out before the 14th Amendment, they wouldn't have had any of those rights. So the things we take for granted that we would say sort of define us by our rights, it's the Reconstruction Amendments. So the Reconstruction Amendments, Thurgood Marshall has this, I think, just wonderful line that while the Union survived the Civil War, the Constitution did not. Mm-hmm. And he means that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments really changed the Constitution in as fundamental a set of ways as you can imagine. It changes the relationship between the states and the federal government, and it dramatically changes the power, not just of Congress, but of minorities to assert rights vis-a-vis any majority. Okay, it does both those things. So the tension between Sherrilyn and Reba, it is in the 14th Amendment itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It gives Congress special responsibility and special powers, but it also says some things simply can't happen. Okay? And it's that tension that has been at the core of some of the things we've been talking about in the last several years. But all of that comes out of the Reconstruction Amendments. So I agree and have and clearly some skepticism about what runaway Ronald Reagan majorities in Congress can legislate. It makes me a little fearful.
Mm-hmm.
We went through that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That said, one of the other problems is the first problem we started talking about. If we don't make ourselves the democracy that we are to be, so that people are actually in it, right, see it as part of them, and have to deal with each other as peers, then we always run the risk of majorities that take care of only themselves,
right,
and have no responsibility to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's how we frame what this debate has to be about. But the tensions we're talking about, how do you work out majorities versus minorities? What's the relationship between Congress and the states? What's the relationship between Congress and the federal government? All of that's in the 14th Amendment. The tension between the three branches comes out of it too. The president has powers to enforce. Congress has powers to, responsibilities to see that it works. People who feel they are aggrieved have rights that come out of the 14th Amendment. These are very interesting things that define us as a democracy, and we ought to be able to frame those issues sort of in the way I just said, so that this discussion is neither threatening, right, nor obscure, but something that would draw people together to figure out how they could see who we are out of this discussion. Right now, it's an obscure discussion.
Mm-hmm. Jack, if you don't mind, I'm gonna pull you in just a minute. But first, I want to ask Christina how questions of citizenship and immigration fit into this larger discussion we're having about equality. And then, Jack, I'd love for you to respond to that as well, and respond to Don's earlier comments. So I
want to say first that I think of this question as of a piece with two other questions that are all about the intersection of U.S. Constitution with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we, in general, tend to focus on the meaning of the Constitution as it applies internally, but there are lots of ways in which the interaction between the U.S. Constitution and the rest of the world matters. So the influence of foreign and international law on domestic legal interpretation and how we assimilate transnational regulatory regimes to the domestic context. And also now how the U.S. Constitution applies outside of U.S. territory after the court's Guantanamo decision. And so I think immigration and how we treat immigrants within the constitutional context is part of those sets of questions of how challenges to our sovereignty should be assimilated into our understanding of the Constitution. But I think the first way to think about this particular issue is that something that we don't often focus on, but it's implicit in some of the anecdotes, for example, Pam's anecdote about Senator Cornyn's view of bilingual ballots, is who is the we and the we the people? And the process of defining the we is a very important part of the process of defining the meaning of the Constitution. And there's, of course, a formal definition of citizenship, which who actually has a citizenship status. But there's also a sociological definition of citizenship that involves people who are stakeholders more generally in the meaning of the Constitution. And that process is largely left to the political process. This is one of those areas, I think, where we really can talk about the Constitution outside of the courts, because the courts play almost no role in defining who gets to fit into either definition of the we. But the important thing is that constitutional values dramatically shape that definition of the we, and who we define as part of or within the ambit of the Constitution says a lot about how seriously we take our constitutional values. And I think one good example that fits within what people describe the Second Reconstruction is the 1965 amendments to the immigration laws that abolished the national origin quotas. This was a law that was passed in the midst of the Civil Rights Revolution as a response in some ways to the 1964 Civil Rights Act that basically declared that we no longer define ourselves as a country according to race or ethnicity. And that was a major change in the definition of who gets to count under the Constitution. And so it's a process that occurs, I think, largely outside of the purview of the courts, but there are a lot of fits and starts in the debate, and even though the courts don't have a role to play, we can talk about defining the we in terms of constitutional values. But I think that creates, or points up to a tension that exists within this project. There are a couple of chapters in the 2020 book, and I think a general movement that's focused on reviving the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment. The clause of the 14th Amendment that basically the slaughterhouse case is read out of existence. That protected the privileges and immunities of national citizenship. And that doesn't mean much today, but there's a desire to make that mean something substantive among lots of progressives. But it displaces what to this day I think has been a focus not on citizenship, but on personhood as the source of rights within the territorial United States. Through the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause that apply universally with some limitations to shift the focus towards the clause that does invoke that formal concept of citizenship that might not line up with the sociological concept and would make more rigid the lines that exist between citizens and non-citizens. And it's not to say that we shouldn't pursue a substantive agenda related to the citizenship clause where there might be economic rights or rights to education guaranteed as a means of ensuring everyone having equal access to participate as a citizen, but it does create a tension that I think in a country like the United States that is historically constituted by the constant replenishment of a population of people from the outside, that is an important thing to be wary of as we try to develop a progressive vision of the Constitution. And I think that just raises the point that the history of the extension of constitutional rights has very much to do with letting more people into the definition of the we who were previously excluded, women and minorities and people like that. And so that part of the obligation, whether it's in the political process or primarily the political process, of ensuring the Constitution's promise, fulfilling the promise, is ensuring people's capacities to actually actively participate as citizens. And that applies whether we're talking about immigrants or people who are, you know, multi-generation Americans. But it does mean focusing on not just the formal definition of citizenship and giving people access to that, but on broader questions about what it means to make someone a functional citizen. And I think that's part of what the project of reintegrating the citizenship clause is about. And it's not incompatible with the universal vision of personhood that's also in the Constitution, but it's an important and difficult line, I think, to balance when we're focused on this particular kind of a question.
Jack.
Let me first talk a little bit about the issue of citizenship, and then let me say something that's importantly related to what Sherilyn was saying that I thought affected me deeply. So, first, citizenship. I think if you've been listening to a steady diet of talk radio, you might get the idea that our Constitution is somehow opposed to the idea of people who are not citizens of the United States becoming citizens. You might believe that our Constitution actually draws a rigid line between citizens and non-citizens. And I want to tell you that's not true. The first thing I want to tell you is that although the first thing, the last thing that was added to the 14th Amendment was the Citizenship Clause, which was mentioned by Christina, you know what that did? That suddenly turned an enormous number of people into citizens at a single stroke. They thought they had done it by the 13th Amendment, but people disputed that, so Citizenship Clause just immediately made a whole large number of people citizens, and it made people citizens on the basis of having been born in the United States, which was a different model than had been occurring in Europe. And not only that, even if you go back to the old Constitution, the 1787 Constitution, it was a uniform law of naturalization. Why was a uniform law of naturalization placed in the federal government? In order to prevent particular states from deciding that they would have a citizenship policy that was extremely restrictive. That is to say, the choice to place at the federal level was to say, we are a country that's going to welcome outsiders. But there's more. If you go back to the 14th Amendment, and you look at the speech that was given by Senator Howard when he introduces the amendment on the floor of the Senate, he does not make the distinction that people in this day make. What he says is, there are privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. And then he goes on to say that these are also enjoyed by other persons who are within the United States. He said he connects this to the idea of equal protection of laws, a way in which I guess people don't talk about it anymore. But if you actually pay attention to the history of our Constitution and its framing, you'll see that the people who drafted the Constitution, the people who drafted the Reconstruction Amendments, understood this to be a country that would continuously welcome many new people to its shores and make them citizens. That is, there was a path to citizenship that would always be present. And if we were true to our Constitution, we would understand that that's still our job today. That's the first point I want to make. Here's the second point I want to make. Sherwin made this point about why African Americans might not trust Congress. And this is true. And between 1875 and 1957, there are no civil rights acts passed in the States. But do you know why there are no civil rights acts passed in the States between 1875 and 1957? Because of the filibuster. Because of the way in which our Senate is constructed. And not just simply the fact that there are two senators per state, which is a malapportionment that we would never permit in any other part of legislation, but rather because there's an internal rule of the Senate that says that you have to have more than a majority. Did you know, you probably know this, that it was almost the case in 1875 that Congress passed a law that would have banned segregation in public schools. 100 years before Brown versus Board of Education, there was a bill that was almost passed in the Senate that would have made Brown irrelevant in 1875. Do you know why that bill didn't pass? Because they couldn't get a supermajority, because of the internal rules of the Congress. Now, in the last several years, Democrats, when they were out of the minority, they thought the filibuster was the most important thing in the Constitution. It's not in the Constitution. Because they didn't want Miguel Estrada to be on the D.C. Circuit. And you know what? That was a stupid idea. They should have agreed at that point in the mid-90s to get rid of the filibuster, not just for judicial nominations, but for every piece of legislation. You know why? Because today, what's holding up health care and a public option? What's holding up voting rights reform? What's holding up almost every important piece of progressive legislation they care about? The supermajority rule in the Senate, which is tied to this gentleman's point about cowardice. But it's not just cowardice. It's because of the way in which small states that don't represent their fair share of Americans are affected both by particular constituencies within the state and also the influence of special interests throughout the state. Those things are magnified by the filibuster rule. Now, you know, I'm not talking, by the way, about rights. I'm talking about an internal procedure in our constitutional structure. And many of the things that you want are actually not being held up because courts aren't doing things. They're not even being held up because legislators are cowards. They're being held up because of the way in which our constitutional structure has been provided to prevent progressive legislation from occurring. So I would be willing to bet that if we didn't have those supermajority requirements in the Congress, the Congress would have been much more respectful of the rights of the American people. And one more thing. The 1964 Civil Rights Act would have been passed a long time before if it hadn't been for the filibuster.
There's something to the structural point. I hear the structural point, but I just have to make a historical point here. Part of the progressive agenda that starts, you know, around the turn of the century, a little bit before, part of the progressive agenda is an accommodation with white supremacy, which we know as Jim Crow.
It is
part of it. There are, you know, very, very robust majorities that don't give, they just don't care at all about what the South is doing to disenfranchise black people, the fact that there are no civil rights laws being enforced, and, you know, maybe there are an instance or two out there, but we have a darker history than simply a procedural problem. It's a much darker history than...
I don't disagree with you, John. I completely agree with you. The point I'm making is not a point that's trying to whitewash, and I use that term advisedly, the dark history of how we have treated minorities in this country. But the point I'm making is that you shouldn't be afraid of the political process, the legislative process, to promote progressive goals. That's the only point I'm making, and there are reforms we could make that could free up the democratic process.
Do something first. And look, Sherwin's point is there was reason to fear the democratic process. Okay, there was reason to fear it in Alabama and Mississippi.
Absolutely.
And in the United States. And there was reason to fear it. So before we want to make the democratic process easier to do things, we need to make sure we have more confidence in how it operates on behalf of everybody. That's why I wanted to reframe this. But these things weren't accidental. We had reason to fear it.
No, I want to move.
I think we're on a different flow now.
Okay, you can come back to it, it's fine. I still love to have an answer to that. But I want to sort of pick up on this, speaking of the flawed democratic process, right? And speaking of federalism issues, as we all know, one of the most prominent constitutional issues of the past decade has been the issue of marriage equality, right? So, you know, what I want to ask now and relate to this very interesting back and forth is,
how are the broader issues of federalism being played out in this debate, and what are the implications for discussions of the Constitution more broadly? So let me ask Reba to answer that question first.
I am so moved by this last exchange.
But they're related, and this is what I'm trying to get you to comment on.
Courts have to come from somewhere, and they ultimately come from political mobilization.
Right.
And so, I mean, I will now talk about marriage equality, but I'm just saying, you can sort of talk about need for protection from politics all you want, but somebody's putting the judges there, and it's a question of who's putting which judges there, and depending on who's there, you're not going to get any protection at all, and you may even get courts intervening in, you know, like actions like took place in New Haven, and, you know, so. Anyway, but now I'll switch to marriage equality.
Some of these same issues are being played out in marriage equality.
I think, you know, earlier on we talked about the idea that constitutions get enforced by the political branches and not just by courts. And I think that for us today, looking at the progress of the marriage equality cause makes us appreciate the sort of fine-tuned creature that the American constitutional order is, because we notice, among other things, that the players in it include states, state constitutional courts, state legislatures, as well as the United States Supreme Court and the Congress. And how do we notice this? Well, we notice that an issue that was inconceivable has been as a matter of right, that is to say that persons of the same sex have a right to marry under the Constitution, has gone from being what Jack would call off the wall to being progressively imaginable, embodied, a question that's emerging. And where is that dynamic happening? It's happening in our state courts. And it's happening in progressive jurisdictions where both the voting public and the judiciary is differently constituted than our federal, you know, Congress or United States Supreme Court. And I think a couple of interesting things that we can pull out of looking at that question. One, that when states are asking and answering this question, they're asking and answering the question about their own constitution, its text, history, meaning, that's answerable to their own citizenry, and yet, as they ask and answer the question, it's being heard outside their jurisdiction, and it's having effects outside their jurisdiction. Not merely the effects of creating opportunities for persons to cross state lines and marry, whose marriages either will or won't be recognized in their home jurisdiction, but it's having semantic effects. It's making claims more plausible. It's making them have essentially legitimacy and plausibility, both. Not only that you can imagine a result, but you can see a result. And I think that dynamic is happening in a way that's crossing borders. So initially, state courts that posed the question were overturned by their state electorates. Vermont did it in a more cautious way, recognizing civil unions, and probably that act helped Massachusetts be the first court to pose the question, and probably the New Hampshire citizenry and court's effort to face down that question altered the possibility of electoral outcomes in other jurisdictions. And so we can see something about the nature of state constitutionalism in this story, which is to say each state has its own constitution, its own history, with its own particular clauses and provisions, and yet the making sense of the fundamental guarantees of speech, of equality, whatnot, has alters people's imaginary and creates dynamics that have effects in other jurisdictions and ultimately begins to alter the question so far as the federal question is concerned. It's really interesting now to watch the fight that's taking place over whether the question should be raised before the United States Supreme Court, because people obviously have a sense that it should reach a certain degree of articulation in the state constitutional system before the Supreme Court. And where did they get that from? They got it from other forms of civil rights, you know, antecedent history. The court ducks the question of Loving against Virginia in the 50s,
right after Brown, and it came around to face it in the 60s because it felt that it could speak with more authority and was less likely to face pushback and backlash because it was more intelligible and familiar to more Americans who, if they were not recognizing this as a plausible claim of law, would tend to see their own court as acting out of line. So the shift in background conditions of plausibility actually empowers courts to act in the longer run. So I think this question gives us a picture of the different arenas and actors and complex literacies that we have. We know states are states. We know they're separate. We also know that they have rippling effects on one another, and that also they're part of the fabric that makes for our understanding of our own federal constitution.
Christina, did you want to jump in on this as well?
It's interesting that there, in the last several years, there's been an emergence of what you might call a progressive federalism. And there are a couple of chapters in the book that talk about this, and it's the embrace by progressives of the potential benefits of federalism. And I don't think it's opportunistic simply because things don't look so good at the federal level anymore. And I don't think it's that gauzy view of the states as the laboratories of democracy or the place where you're most connected to your politicians. So you have this kind of sincere Jeffersonian form of democracy. I think it's a description of how social change actually occurs, and it's that it happens at multiple levels of decision-making, and that one of the functions that federalism can actually perform is helping a country that's as large and diverse as the United States come to terms with social change, not necessarily in an incremental way, but in a way that doesn't require national consensus, but that can actually occur through different branches of government and among different communities that have different sets of values or different points along the spectrum and their understanding of an idea. And I think you see this clearly also in the immigration context. We have some states that want to recruit immigrants, that resist federal enforcement, and that think that it's central to their economy. New York City is a place that's very immigrant-friendly. And others that want to enforce federal law with vengeance and have no interest in allowing immigrants to become part of that we, in the we the people. And so I think the processes that are going on are precisely the processes that federalism can help manage, which is coming to terms with fundamental social change. But in some ways, to me, is the most interesting question is what impact we think that ultimately will have or should have on the national debate or on national consensus. And I think the end game for marriage equality, even for those who think we should let it happen through the states, is that eventually we'll come to a national consensus and there will be a federal norm where marriage equality is recognized as a matter of federal constitutional understanding. But that's not necessarily the case in all issues, and certainly I don't think it will ever be the case on an issue like immigration, for example, or other kinds of regulatory issues that are less about core values and more about how you make particular trade-offs. And I also think what's interesting is the amount of time that it takes and for something to become a national norm. And the other example I think of here is the death penalty, where developments in the states have had an influence on the way the Supreme Court has understood what aspects of the death penalty are constitutional and are not. So the juvenile death penalty and execution of the mentally disabled, strongly influenced by developments in the states, but yet the death penalty itself has been very resistant to an articulation of the federal norm against the practice altogether. And so there are trade-offs that are being enacted through, I think, a dialogue that's going on among the different levels of government. And sometimes the court plays a very activist role and sometimes it doesn't. And an understanding not just what that role should be, but what it takes to get the court to play that role from the perspective of an activist, I think, is an important part of the struggle. And with respect to marriage equality, I somehow feel like there's a tipping point, right, where it's not that you have to have a majority of states, it's that it's become so commonplace in the culture that the court may just decide it's time to recognize it, which is why I don't think the federal lawsuit is as misguided as some people think. I think there's this belief that this particular type of social change has occurred quite rapidly, and it's also generational in a way that's very different from the death penalty or other issues that have made their way through this kind of federalist dynamic and eventually emerge as constitutional. But that could be wrong. It could be wrong in an assessment of where the court actually is.
Well, in any event, what has to happen when a judge faces that question, him or herself, is the question, if I were to find this right, is it going to be received by those who don't agree with me
as a credible picture of what the Constitution, protective of individual liberties, requires, or just something from some other world, not mine?
And so it doesn't actually have to be reach a point that everyone agrees or even that most people agree, but that it shifts from being just simply unthinkable or something that they think over there to something that reasonable people could think even if I don't. And in that space, I think we have a rule of law culture such that people will defer if it's within that space of manageability. And that's a very complex mapping that's going on, and different justices will ask and answer the questions differently about how far they're prepared to push people on which questions in that space.
Mm-hmm.
Can I
add
to the piece?
Sure.
From the executive,
which please.
How a court gets to the point that Reeve was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's been a lot of conversation about, you know, President Obama and don't ask, don't tell. And I think it's worthwhile to remember as we think about the background that creates the context, whether at the state level or the federal level. If we want to think about what are all of the pieces that become part of the constitutional fidelity kind of analysis that's discussed in the book, we can't kind of leave out the power of the president. Because two of the most important actions taken that I think we sometimes lose sight of in thinking about the development of, particularly of civil rights law in the 20th century, are really two presidential executive orders. One horrible, one great. The horrible one is President Roosevelt's executive order, which allows General DeWitt to essentially conduct the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. The second positive one is President Truman's executive order desegregating the military. And those two pieces are actually very important to what then happened over the next 15 to 20 years within the realm of civil rights. And even if we take it all the way up to, you know, the military brief that's submitted in the Grutter and Rott case, you know, which is kind of the child of that executive order, we begin to understand that the president has a role to play also, mm-hmm. and that even as we're having a conversation about legislation and about the courts, we do need to remember that the president's executive authority and power helps to create the backstory, helps to create the context, helps to change conditions on the ground that may lead to that point where people begin to think, you know, even if I disagree with it, it's not so off the wall, and kind of can set the stage for some of the kind of progressive action that we talked about. And so I just think sometimes we spend a lot of time talking about the tension between Congress and the courts,
exactly.
and we make it as though the president is a potted plant, and he's not, or she is not, one day. They have a lot of power and authority, not just the power and authority to do something kind of today on the ground, but to affect the context in which courts will later look at some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. I want to switch gears now and talk a little bit about the rights of the accused and point out this is another area, unfortunately, that we have seen the reduction of rights through a number of decisions by the Supreme Court and other courts over the last several years. Pam, can you weigh in on this and say a little bit about what needs to change to assure, you know, full constitutional rights for those accused of crimes?
Well, two things that come, I think, out of the discussion we've been having so far. One of them is John's point about if you ask people what do they think their rights include, they think their right includes the right to a lawyer. It's the only affirmative right, actually,
mm-hmm.
in the federal constitution, the right to a lawyer if you're accused of crime. The only place where the government has to spend money to give you a right. And yet, the Supreme Court has whittled that down in a variety of ways while leaving the principle there. And the biggest one of these is its definition of what counts as effective assistance of counsel. There is a wide literature with a conflict among the circuits, a deep conflict among the circuits, and lots of discussion about how long does your lawyer have to be asleep during your criminal trial for it to be ineffective. You have some circuits that say it depends how long the lawyer was asleep. You have other circuits that say, no, it's not the length of time he was asleep, it's which moments of the case was he asleep. And the idea that we could have an argument about this in which the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said it was a strategic decision of the lawyer to sleep because he thought it would help his client get the jury's sympathy. Well, you know, if this is the level at which we talk about the effective assistance of counsel, then we have a real problem. And so I think the the most important thing is to fund defense counsel adequately. Because a lot of the rights that are on the books never get vindicated because the lawyer doesn't know about them. There are cases where you ask the lawyer, death penalty cases, where they're trying to show lawyer was ineffective, and they said, lawyer, can you name any Supreme Court decisions in criminal procedure? And the lawyer says, Brown against Board of Education. Admittedly, a great case. Not so much a case about criminal procedure. Right? So the people might all be able to say, well, I know about these rights because I watched Law and Order, but the lawyers apparently don't. They're asleep. They fall asleep already. So one thing is we need better effective assistance of counsel. The second thing that we need beyond effective assistance of counsel, and that means funding adequately the provision of defense counsel, is to recognize that this is an area in which the Supreme Court has cut back dramatically over the last, say, 30 years, mm-hmm. not by getting rid of Warren Court or early Berger Court precedents, but by what I call circumruling them, getting around the edges of them. So the court will say, well, yes, it violates the Constitution for you to treat suspects this way, but if you get evidence, you can still use it. So they have whittled away at the exclusionary rule without coming up with anything else that will enforce the protections of the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments generally. And the second thing to recognize, and this goes back to the federalism point, is the Supreme Court has regulated criminal procedure rather a lot. So they talk a lot about, you know, what can the police do or not do in a search or in an interrogation, what burdens of proof do you have to have, when do you get the right to a jury trial, and like, they have done nothing on the two more important issues, which they have left almost entirely to the states and to the political process. First is, what can be defined as a crime? They've done nothing to talk about that. And so you get this kind of plethora of hyper-criminalization of things. And they've done nothing to talk about what is an appropriate punishment for a crime once somebody's been convicted. And I think those two issues have to come kind of front and center, because most of our criminal law right now, and most of the reason we have seen this huge upsurge in incarceration, is not because there are more murders going on or more robberies going on or more rapes. It's because of the creation of bizarre drug laws sort of things that look like auctions gone out of control when the legislature sits around to figure out the punishment. So the crack powder distinction, right, started off, the first bill in Congress was that they would punish a possession of crack at twice the punishment for powder cocaine. And that kind of made sense on a whole lot of grounds. And then some congressmen say, well, I think it should be five times as much. And others say, I'll see your five and raise you 10. And others say, 10? That sounds low. How about 20? And that's how you, I mean, it was like a bidding war when they got up to 100-1. And so I think we need to talk about what should be made a crime and what's an appropriate punishment for a crime, as well as how do we provide people with adequate defense.
Great. Thank you, Pam. Speaking of due process, Jack, even the not-so-progressive Supreme Court slapped the hands of the Bush administration for its illegal detention practices and military commission system. Yet the Obama administration, unfortunately, in my opinion, now appears poised to endorse some form of preventive detention for terrorism detainees. What are the broader implications of the decision that Obama has yet to make, so we can still influence him, on this and other national security and civil liberties matters?
I want to start with what Charlotte made, which is that here's an example of where the president's construction in this, executive orders, administrative regulations, decisions within the Office of Legal Counsel really tell you what the Constitution means on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
This is true. It's not just true with Truman, but of course that was national security too, right? But also in this case. I know this maybe will sound blasphemous to you, but preventive detention is not in itself a problem. There is preventive detention in the law of war. That's not what the issue is, guys. So that when you hear that Barack Obama is about to sign an order on preventive detention, the word preventive detention shouldn't be the thing that gets you upset. What should get you upset are the following questions. Under what conditions do you declare someone subject to the laws of war as opposed to some other? What kind of hearing do they get beforehand? The second question is, are you holding them for purposes of preventing them from returning to the battlefield, or are you holding them purely for interrogation purposes, which is very different and not permitted, right? And second of all, how often are you going to go back to check about their decisions about dangerousness? Are you going to leave them there forever? Those are the issues. And the thing that leads you to a more general point, which is, this example is a more general point of something I think people haven't quite understood. Everybody got really upset about George Bush, and they confused two different questions.
Mm-hmm.
One question was building out a particular kind of state, and the other was how you built out that kind of state. Let me explain. Since the Clinton administration, through George Bush and Barack Obama, the United States has been building out a particular form of policies and institutions designed, which we might call preventative or surveillance-based. I call it in this chapter the national surveillance state. The idea is to identify threats to the country and to use information, collect information, and to analyze it in order to hold off and prevent threats before they happen. They could be threats to national security. They could be problems that have to do with delivery of social services. They could be responding to disasters like Katrina or something like that. This is a form of governance that's been developing over a large number of years, and George Bush didn't invent it. In fact, the terrorism bill started in the Clinton administration, and a lot of the stuff occurs in the Clinton administration. What happened was that, as they say, September 11th concentrated the mind on this particular form of governance. And then the guy who got a chance to build it out first was none other than George W. Bush, and he made a hash of it. He made all sorts of mistakes. And in fact, he actually, over time, he freed himself to some degree from the terrible things that Cheney was suggesting. And then in the second administration, it was getting a little bit better. Now, the important thing to understand is Barack Obama is not going to get rid of this form of governance. He is going to produce a preventive detention system. He is going to collect information. He is going to continue NSA programs that collect information. He's going to do all these things. So that isn't going to go away. And if that's what you were upset with, you should be upset with the Democrats as much as the Republicans. What you should demand of him is that when he builds out these new forms of state power, that he does so in a way that is not arbitrary, that respects basic conceptions of human dignity and human decency, that has fail-safe mechanisms built into it, and most important, again, I'm sorry, it's not about courts, has built-in checks and balances within the executive branch, so that somebody in the executive branch is watching what the NSA does and audits what the NSA does and makes sure that they don't engage in any funny business. Because courts are never going to really know what the NSA is doing. Let me tell you, it's just not going to happen. You have to build those fail-safe mechanisms into the executive branch in a way that no court is ever going to touch. That's the constitutional problem we face today. How do we structure the executive branch so it treats people decently, so it respects the national law? That's our problem.
I think we should open it up and bring you all into this conversation. So let's just open it up for questions from the audience. If you guys could please come up to the microphone, because we are recording the event. So, or Tom's going to be great. There you go. I think it's not on. Sorry about that. I don't think it's working.
And you started out by noting that we don't have a right to vote. That is, it's not explicit, not affirmative. Should we have one? And what would it say? And would it matter? I say, why would it matter? Because I think the court would still be free to give us the Indiana ID case under the rubric of a right to vote. So I'm not sure it makes any difference.
Well, I think it does make some difference. In the following sense, if Congress were to take seriously the idea of the right to vote, they could do a lot. And this goes back maybe a little bit to Jack's point about cloture and to a bunch of other points. But we now have a Congress that actually is elected by a much broader cross-section of the American people than was true prior to the Voting Rights Act. And so if Congress actually thought they were right to vote, Congress could pass a bill that says, if a state wants somebody to have an ID in order to vote, the state has to provide them with that ID. And it has to provide them with all the documents they need to get that ID. And if the state hasn't done that, then they can't deny somebody the right to vote on the basis of that. So I think there are ways that having an affirmative right to vote and understanding that the right to vote is not a privilege, it's a right. And I still go back to, you know, I took all these depositions in Arkansas when we were doing a voting rights case in the 1980s, and I would say to the registrar, do you consider the right to vote a right or a privilege? And they all would say, it's a privilege. Right? And so it's something that has to be earned, and if you don't follow the rules precisely, then it's your fault. I mean, think back to Justice O'Connor in the Bush against Gore argument saying, well, why can't these people all just follow the rules? You know, if you didn't punish the cat out all the way, it's your fault, not the fault of the state for having dull backs in the voting booths and like. And so I think some of it is just making people understand in the way that other democracies all have. I mean, this is one of the kind of staggering things is there's no other Western democracy in the world that treats its voting system the way we do, that devolves it down to the local level, that doesn't supervise it, that doesn't fund it, that has it all run in most of the country by partisans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the idea that somebody is running for governor of Ohio and is also serving as secretary of state and thereby throwing out registration forms because they're not on 80-pound proof paper, that does not happen in the rest of the world. In 2000, we had our election, and Canada had its national election. The Canadians used paper ballots, so they had a ballot trail. They counted all the votes in 48 hours using civil servants. Until they went to a new computerized system in Canada, the government went door to door registering people to vote. You know, we wouldn't have the problems we have if the government took the idea that people should be allowed to vote seriously. Mm-hmm. And so I do think talking about it and getting people to understand that this is an obligation the government has would change somewhat both what the laws are that get passed and ultimately down the road the court's willingness to uphold laws that affirmatively give people the right to vote and to be skeptical of laws that restrict people's access to the ballot.
So it doesn't matter whether it's in the
No, I don't think. I think the combination of the Elections Clause and the Enforcement Clause of the 14th Amendment gives you enough to argue for an affirmative right to vote. I don't think you need a constitutional amendment.
And it is in the Constitution. It is in the 1787 Constitution. It's a guarantee of a Republican form of government, representative government. And by Republican, they don't mean the Republican Party. They mean
smaller.
Smaller.
Republican, not large.
Dynamic. At the time that that constitution was ratified, voting was closer to a privilege in the sense that it was restricted property. That the percent, I don't know if people have ever gone to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, but there's different things to be said about the exhibition, but one thing you could do is go around and see at different moments in history whether you would be entitled to vote.
Great.
So there's a long history of the vote being a minority right, which over time has shifted. And so people's background sort of readiness to believe that it's a right is certainly greater and a right of all, is certainly greater now than it was 100 years ago. And then also there's this long history of white supremacist concern about restricting the franchise. And so there's also, but it has the language of federalism and state autonomy. It's an interesting question now if we just press this thing at the national level as a matter of national federal law and just change the without even saying take the federal government take over state elections, but the states would have to explain why they were going to opt out of it.
Yeah, I think one statistic that I find absolutely staggering, which is if you go back to 1870, which is when the 15th Amendment was ratified, and you say, how many people did the 15th Amendment give the right to vote to? Gave the right to vote to approximately 1.6 million black men, because it only provided the right to vote for men. It didn't provide it for women. And I went back and I looked at the census figures and I figured out how many black men in the country were there over the age of 21 in 1870. If you ask how many black men are disenfranchised today by state laws that disenfranchise people because they've been convicted of a crime, it's exactly the same number.
Yeah.
So we have now disenfranchised as many people as the 15th Amendment enfranchised. And so some of this is just talking about, it goes up and down. That is, it has not been a triumphalist story in America that we've ever expanded the right to vote. And we may be right now in a period where we're seeing some constrictions of the right to vote. And part of our job, I think, is to push back on that and argue much more for an affirmative right to vote.
I would say that this is started out not having really national elections. So in the first presidential campaigns, there is no national vote tallied because that's not what happened. People voted for electors, and the members of the Senate actually got elected by the state legislature. And so we're living in an anachronism. So we now look at national elections as though they ought to be have some uniformity, and Pam's description is right. It must be bizarre to everybody to realize that it's not state by state. It is county by county inside of states, have different ballots, counted in different ways. You can be in one state and have electronic voting in one county, and the next one it can be paper, and the next one it can be different paper. Okay, all tabulated in different ways. It makes no sense whatsoever. And there's really nobody out there saying, I really like the inefficiency and chaos that comes out of that. And I believe Congress could exercise some power with the leadership of the president to say, this is how we're going to conduct, starting out, our national election. And that would have an effect on the other elections in the state. But if this is how we're going to conduct our election for federal officers, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to do the next presidential election. A lot of people would say, ooh, boy, I feel a lot better that we're going to have the same ballot out there. But that requires some political will from Congress and some leadership from a president that could get that done. I think you could do it under the existing set of regulations we have in our Constitution. I don't think there's a constitutional problem here. There's a can we actually push it out there to get it done. We're living in an anachronism.
Yeah, there are a lot of folks working on that, which we're happy about. So let's go to the next question.
I'm Michael Myers with the New York Civil Rights Coalition. First, let me acknowledge and thank the panel for a very smart conversation. Usually these kind of things, after 5 minutes, I'm out of here. Because I've heard it all before, and so full of racial rhetoric, but this is a very, very smart, deep panel. Thank you. My question is pushing you, though, to look at the tension between individual rights and group discrimination or group rights or group identity. Because I think Lily and I were having a conversation about the difference between being a liberal and being a progressive, and my thought was that being a progressive means you're results-oriented. Being a liberal is you're open-minded, you're looking for reform, you want to undo injustice. And when people were denied the right to vote because they were black, that was an injustice, and liberal people said, we cannot have that. Now, you go from being a liberal to going to the point where people now are asserting rights, and I've used that word in quotes, because of their identity in terms of race, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of language minority, et cetera. And the question, the point is that with respect to citizenship, people do expect that you are fluent in the language. And there's a difference between a person who may need, as a person, as an individual, help in terms of translation or help with interpreting a ballot, and a language minority that says, we got to have our ballot in Spanish or in some other language because we have a certain number of people in the population. You have to respect us as an identity group as opposed to individuals who are trying to vote and exercise our constitutional rights. And therefore, you're losing, going to Reba's point, in terms of the constitutional democracy, you're losing people who are ordinarily on your side because of the tension between affirming individual rights and not wanting to affirm group identity. And so my question relates to the issue of affirmative action, because my theory, going to John's point about white supremacy, and the legacy of that, and although there's been a lot of progress in this country against white supremacy, and all that entails. But my question with respect to affirmative action is, the people who have crudely designed affirmative action remedies, seems to me, have done it in such a way, in such a crude fashion, that it's very tough for John, and for legal defensemen, and for ACLU, and for other litigators, to go to court to defend these crude programs. And I think the people who design these things want these things to fail, want the Supreme Court to say, no, as they said in Marbury v. Madison, we look for the individual right, and whether it's a law or a practice is moving up against an individual's right, then the court is here to protect the individual to the extent that we can so by interpreting the Constitution. So that is the kind of tension I want the panel to address, because people of goodwill don't want race discrimination. But they also don't want race discrimination if it means that individuals who have taken a test, which has been validated by a locality as being job-related, and then because the results are different, then these individuals who happen to be white get, say, you can't get promotion because we have to have blacks. And but the liberal says, yeah, we ought to have blacks, and we have, but we have to defend an indefensible fat pattern. I hope you understand the question.
Sherilyn, go for it.
I'm parallel with you. I'll be very brief. First on the last book, there's a lot there. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm sure John can speak to this better than I can. You know, you look at this Seattle school district case, you know, an extremely modest, extremely narrowly tailored effort to provide integration in the school system. And what was most interesting about that case was that essentially what Chief Justice Roberts said was that the narrow tailoring, the fact that it was very, very modest, meant that it couldn't be compelling. So now when you don't do it crudely as you describe it, that somehow is evidence that there is no compelling justification for it. So I don't really think, Michael, that it's about the form of affirmative action. I think it is about the fact that affirmative action has become the depository of many unresolved issues of white supremacy, and we can, that's a much longer conversation than certainly I'm prepared to have. The second piece was I just wanted to just hit historically on this question about language minorities and ballots. My adopted state now is Maryland, and we've had pretty vigorous conversations about this because we had a comptroller a few years ago and a Republican governor a few years ago who talked about this in precisely the way you did, that, you know, this is very alienating, that we're all Americans and that you have no right to have a ballot in your own language. And a very intrepid reporter from what was then an actual newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, did some research on the families of both Governor Ehrlich and the then comptroller William Donald Schaefer, both of whom are German descended. And if you know anything about Maryland, you know that Germans were very much in control of a good deal of the politics, economics, and so forth in the state of Maryland, particularly in the city of Baltimore. This included the use of German language ballots, German education. This existed all the way through the 19th century into the early 20th century. In fact, there's still a church in Baltimore, that Zion Lutheran Church is, you know, one of the few churches in the country that continues to conduct all its services in German. The reality is that the history is contrary to what you're describing. It's contrary to this idea that never before have we required people to have ballots and that somehow this is undermining our kind of national identity. In fact, particularly where Germans are concerned, it was actually quite common for Germans to be recognized as a political constituency, to have their own language ballot, to have their own education, to be power players in the political process, and that this was recognized for not just 1 year or 2 years, but for over a century. And so I just think it's important to just place that in historical context.
Can I add one thing to that language piece?
Yeah.
The original provision in the Voting Rights Act, and Pam can correct me on the details if I'm wrong, was to ensure that Puerto Ricans who were voting in New York or were educated in Puerto Rico could vote. And they were citizens. I've been hoping the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor will make people realize that Puerto Ricans are citizens of the United States. I think it's not a winnable battle even if they become a state. But, and then when it was added to, then the Voting Rights Act was amended in the mid-70s as a way of compensating for the educational deficiencies of, and discrimination against Mexican-Americans in the Southwest. And so the remedy of the bilingual ballot may not have been the perfect remedy, but it was thought to be a way of ensuring that people who had as equal a claim to citizenship as anyone else were able to exercise the franchise. And it goes to Pam's larger point, I think, which is that voting should not be about your qualifications. It should be a universal right that's understood to apply regardless. But the historical reason for the bilingual ballot, coupled with what Sherilyn just said, make it something that's very difficult to argue against with the kind of claim these are not people who are Americans. It's very much about incorporating Americans into the electorate.
It's very hard to have. Well, I appreciate the question about affirmative action, and you know what I'm about to say. It's very hard to have an honest discussion of this topic because it's so loaded. And one of the challenges we all face It's not, there are some poorly devised programs, but that's not the main problem. It's how difficult it is to discuss it when people bring things to it when you use any language out there. So to have a discussion that lets everyone think that the test was in fact fair, you can't have the rest of the discussion. Okay? So if we started somewhere else where what if they were using a test that everyone knew was discriminatory? Okay? That'll lead to another conclusion there. So how you start this discussion out will again drive the ending. It's very hard to have the honest discussion. It's easier if I talk about something that doesn't seem to involve everybody in today's battle because everyone's already decided that in their mind. Okay? What happened in New Haven? Everyone in here thinks they know what the right outcome should have been or was. Okay? If I say, let me tell you the case that gets us to New Haven. Okay? It is a sort of a core case in the Civil Rights Movement. Congress passes the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It makes racial discrimination unlawful. Duke Power Company in North Carolina has had a racially discriminatory hiring practice for its entire history. It says no black people can actually perform the following job. 1964 Civil Rights Act is passed. Duke takes down that prohibition and replaces it with a high school graduation requirement. And when you do the demographics, it turns out that was the same filter. Okay? The same filter. There weren't any black men who would, you know, and therefore Jack Greenberg, LDF, brings a lawsuit against a Duke Power Company, and it says, this is just another form of discrimination. You used a requirement that actually chose white males, and it turns out that the jobs you're talking about doesn't require anything that is encompassed in a high school graduation. Okay? That goes to the Supreme Court. It's Griggs versus Duke Power, and disparate impact comes out of that case. Supreme Court says, whoa, you can't do that. That's just discrimination. When you use something that actually yields only, you know, one race, that's a disparate impact, and it has no job-related indicia to it, okay? So if I start there, okay, if New Haven used a test that discriminated, right, in how the outcomes came, and it had no relationship to what they wanted to happen on the job, okay? And everybody says, well, that's not the New Haven case I know. Okay, that's my point. It's very hard to discuss these things. And part of the battle here is to actually be able to work out the original facts in a way that everyone can understand them. One of the tragedies of the New Haven case is that that test was not litigated. Okay, that's one of the tragedies. And it means people can just pour into it whatever they think they know for sure what happened. Okay, but whether that test was discriminatory or not was not litigated. Okay, and that won't happen next time. Okay, because the court has created a tremendous incentive to simply just file the lawsuit. Let's just file the lawsuit. Okay, that's the disservice in this discussion. Because if we start with everybody ought to be able to have selection criteria and tests that do not discriminate against anybody out there. And I think if anybody knows anything about tests, that is more difficult to design than you may think, because you may think you know what it is that it requires for someone to do the following job, but it may not be a multiple choice test that will get you there at all. Okay? You may not hire anybody using multiple choice tests because it sounds completely silly. So what is the multiple choice test? It turns out to be very, very sophisticated. I think people would say you would never want to use one to pick a leader, that's a captain and lieutenant in the fire department as opposed to entry level. But I'm just saying we can't get to that discussion the way the thing gets framed, but we have to work on how we actually can discuss these things because we still have entire job categories, police, firemen, where in fact they have unbelievably long and nasty histories of racial exclusion that has come forward to right now. You can see some of the remnants right now. So we have to have a better discussion, I hear that. And maybe we have to explain these things better, I hear that. But it's not that we don't need some of these remedies, some of these efforts to make sure that the tests and selection criteria out there are fair to everybody. We absolutely need that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very quickly.
I just wanted to throw in one point, which in a certain way is
responsive to the exchange with Cheryl earlier about the courts in this story and my saying it matters so much to mobilize people to put judges there. And that's the following, that the whole run of cases in which the court is talking about the meaning of equal protection or equality are all of these cases in which they're the so-called reverse discrimination cases. Meanwhile, the cases, like Pam was talking about the question of the sentencing guidelines, drug cases, and all of that, the court is just completely like give it a free pass. So, there's like, Jack and I have an essay in the book, Remembering How to Do Equality, in which we're talking about the structure of equality law right now. There's two narratives. One is strong presumption of unconstitutionality, and the court goes in, and it's very kind of hyper-scrutinizing everything, controlling the political branches. And the other is strong presumption of constitutionality, total deference, no oversight. And so, in all of the anything resembling facially neutral laws, the court has creating no second guess, explain yourself, worry about the impact, you're just total silence. So a different kind of question, it's really hard to explain the New Haven case, but I also think we should look at what Cal says, the equality cases this court is interested in, and the equality cases this court isn't interested in. And if we show to this set of stories, this is where this court is focused, but it's never even looking here. It's actually helping bring into being a politics of resentment, and it's failing to get people to stand up and assert themselves in politics to acknowledge that issue. So I think we almost need to back one step out and say, this is what they're worried about. This is where they're never asking for a double check. That's the problem. That's bias. You know?
After 9/11, the Supreme Court denied cert in Brown versus Lee Mogiana. Most of us know about, right? This is the case where they go on the campus and they get all the black men on the campus based on this very, vague description. I mean, this is a case that the Supreme Court decides, not to take. I mean, this is a shocking case. This is an important case.
What's like crazy about that case? So in this case, yeah, they're using race as a suspect description,
and
right?
This is not facially neutral.
That's not a racial classification. When they say strict scrutiny, all racial classifications, somehow or other, there's and race is one of multiple factors. Well, so is it an affirmative action?
Right. Guys, we have a very patient questioner, and I really want to get to his question, and have a quick question and a very quick answer, and we have to close. I'm so sorry we get kicked out of the room.
Okay. Well, after all this, my name is Keith Roberts. I'm a lawyer here in New York. Mm-hmm. After all this, I'm really curious as to what your answers might be to the very first question that was posed, because it all comes down to who the judges are. Mm-hmm. And when people like John Cornyn are picking them, you get what you're getting. Mm-hmm. So how do you frame the discussion in a way that the public understands the liberal point of view, because I think we would all agree that Ronald Reagan and Edwin Meese and their successors have beaten our pants off in terms of framing matter for public discussion.
Great final question. A couple of answers.
One of the things that I've been talking about, and I was actually excited to see that the last two district court appointments that President Obama made are two attorneys who are former public defenders, because that's one of the things I've been talking about. So I haven't been talking about it just in terms of race and gender and being liberal and not liberal. I've been talking about kind of the blackballing of criminal defense attorneys from being considered for federal judgeships, being considered for the United States Supreme Court, not being put in the pipeline from the district courts, because the idea of affecting kind of the character of what cases get taken, of what cases are reheard in bank, of how the judges themselves regard issues is very much tailored not only to the personnel as it relates to kind of the diversity that we tend to think about in this conversation, but also the professional experience diversity. And so if we're going to talk about criminal justice, how is it that, if you want to be on the United States Supreme Court, the track is now you're a former U.S. attorney, you're a former, appellate court judge. I think it's Thurgood Marshall, maybe the last justice that actually defended a criminal defendant, certainly in a capital case, they've basically been excluded. So I think it's interesting. I was just looking at the appointment sheet that the last two, one in Florida and one in another state, I don't remember, district court judges are former federal public defenders. that's one way, you know, just another way of talking about the personnel on the bench, that it's not just about, you know, just hitting, you know, Sonia Sotomayor, great nominee, former prosecutor. You know, what's wrong with criminal defense attorneys? What's wrong with having that perspective on the bench also and in the conference? So I think we've got to, you know, open up ourselves to thinking about what the personnel on our courts should look like.
Very briefly. Yep.
I actually think that this is the topic that the books are about.
Mm-hmm.
The Reagan folks redefined some of these questions in a way that put us on the defensive. So on the question of criminal justice, I would say liberal politicians have been on the defensive and remain. They don't want to look like they're doing things that will set criminals free or make it easier for them to get off. And it's very hard to reframe that. So part of the challenge is to figure out how to actually reframe that and do it with some confidence. There is something wrong with how our criminal justice system is now working. There are millions of people in prison, you know, laws and regimes that simply are unfair. I believe it's still the case that every single person on death row had a court-appointed lawyer. A stunning fact. Every single person on death row had a appointed. I'm just saying that people get very good people on appeal. Okay, but they got lost at trial when things just got waived. Mm-hmm. So it does matter here. You know, there was one case in the Supreme Court where Scalia decided that you can now use an illegally obtained confession to impeach somebody. Okay, they say every other piece of legal evidence you can use to impeach, now you can use an illegally obtained confession to impeach somebody. So if they take the stand, you can impeach them. And since, they, you know, if they take the stand, you can't let them perjure themselves. Let me tell you what happens. This is the incentive point. That will create an incentive among the police that we've got you. I now want to intentionally get you to confess. I'll tell you, you have a right to a lawyer. I'm not going to give you one. Okay, I'm going to keep talking to you, and you, if you sign this, you're out of here. I can't use the confession at all. Go ahead. If you want to get out of here, and the police will get a confession, and what that did was you can never take the stand. Okay, it creates an incentive to get that confession, so you will never take the stand. Because if you take the stand, they say, isn't there a point where you confess, and that's the end of you. We have to reframe this in the sense of what we want out of our criminal justice system, what the judges have to be to get that, okay, and why we are a better society if we live up to the values that we want to, you know, let the world see we are. That's what we have to do.
I'm sorry, we just don't have time. We're going to kick us out of the room. I want to first thank Tom Hilding again for all the great work that he put into planning this panel. And then to thank our very lively panelists for making the Constitution come alive. So thank you very much.